Kirstjen Nielsen is out as Secretary of Homeland Security. Today, Congressman Darren LaHood gives us his reaction, and we talk about trade and ag. Plus, Boeing 737 MAX 8 has been grounded for nearly a month after two fatal crashes, the latest on the Illinois-based company. And in the lead-up to Easter, many Christians go for fish instead of meat on Fridays. Today, we're talking about local fish fries. Do you have a favorite? Text us at 217-394-5765.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
All that and more coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, Boeing is being sued by families of some of the people who have died in two fatal plane crashes that involved the 737 MAX 8 jet. The Illinois-based company also saw its shares drop by more than 4% yesterday. We'll get an update on all of that and more. And for many churchgoers throughout Illinois, it's the time of year when you can count on eating fish on Fridays, especially fried fish, whether it's at a local restaurant or a fish fry. Today, we're talking to a few places, but we want to hear from you. If you have a favorite, text us. Our number is 217-394-5765. That's 217-394-5765. Please include your first name so we can read it on the air. But first, you may have seen the latest news out of Washington. Kirstjen Nielsen has become the most recent cabinet member to leave the Trump administration. She served as Secretary of Homeland Security, which included overseeing the border between the U.S. and Mexico. This weekend, she announced her resignation. I had a chance to check in with Republican Congressman Darren LaHood about that yesterday afternoon, just before he headed back to Washington. We also talked about ag, trade with China, and flooding. Congressman LaHood represents Illinois' 18th congressional district, which includes all or part of 19 counties across central and western Illinois, including parts of Peoria, Springfield, Bloomington, Normal. Congressman, welcome back to the 21st.
Great to be with you and your listeners today.
So there's a lot of Illinois news I wanted to ask you about, but I wanted to just start with the big news in Washington regarding the resignation of Homeland Security head Kirstjen Nielsen this weekend. That was a couple of days after the abrupt withdrawal of the nomination of acting ICE Enforcement Director Ron Vitilio as well. The Trump administration believed both of them weren't tough enough on immigration, especially when it came to the child separation policy. Do you agree that she wasn't tough enough?
Well, I think a couple things. It's not a surprise to me that Secretary Nielsen decided to step down. I think, she had some policy disagreements with the president. And to your point, I think this administration ran on this issue of tougher immigration policy. And I don't think Secretary Nielsen necessarily coincided with her views with the president. I think she served the office well. And this is something that the president has put front and center as an issue and continues to be frustrated by issues along the border, the humanitarian crisis there. And I think it was his prerogative to go a different direction.
Are you frustrated by what's going on at the border?
Well, I think there's a collective frustration from the standpoint that, we have almost 75,000 people each month we're averaging coming across the border, or trying to come across the border illegally. And how do we get a handle on that? How do we stop that? I think is really what the president is trying to get at. We are a country of laws, and we have to abide by those laws. And in a prior life, I spent 5 years as a federal prosecutor. I've prosecuted lots of immigration cases. I've sent people back to their country of origin. But listen, we need to enforce those laws. And I think the president, just this last week, got the attention of Mexico by threatening to shut down the border. I'm glad he didn't do that, but it got their attention. And also looking at how do we get countries like El Salvador and Guatemala and Nicaragua and others to pay attention to this crisis. So I think this is something that is an issue for people in my district, and there's been a lot of collective frustration.
And when we're thinking about what you were saying about President Trump's threat to close the border, I just wanted to ask you just about, threats aside, what we're seeing, and I'm thinking of the Mexican Auto Industry Association said earlier this week there's very serious delays in exporting goods across the U.S.-Mexico border, how much that's impacting the auto industry. And this is actually moving border agents from commercial to immigration duties. Are you concerned about Illinois manufacturers and their ability to trade across the border right now being affected by this?
Of course, absolutely. You know, Mexico is our second largest trading partner. It has to be at the top of the list, the economic ramifications and how it affects not only manufacturing, but our agriculture products. You know, 98% of the corn that Mexico imports comes from the United States, much of it from Illinois and the Midwest. So, of course, I have concerns about that. I look at closing the border as a last resort. But again, the president threatened it. But in the end, he decided that he's going to give Mexico the opportunity to change some of their policies. And he made the decision not to do that. So, yes, economic considerations have to be at the forefront.
I do want to get back to agriculture, but I just want to ask you about one other big business story that has been in the headlines for the past month, and that relates to Boeing. Of course, they're based here in Illinois, even if they don't do manufacturing here, which makes them one of Illinois' biggest companies. Do you trust Boeing leadership right now to be handling this 737 MAX 8 crisis, especially given the news, recent news reports we've seen about how the two crashes have been handled?
I do. I think that there's top quality people at Boeing, but I think safety comes first. I think they understand that. You know, they've been a top quality company, but we need to take a pause here. And I think Boeing recognizes that. I think they're doing that right now. And listen, we need to let the experts at the FAA do their work, find out exactly what happened with the two very unfortunate crashes. And let the experts and the folks that are involved with these do what they need to do. Listen, I think there'll be a time and place to look further into what Boeing did or didn't do. But thus far, I've been satisfied with their response. But we need to get to the bottom of what occurred, fix that, remedy that problem. And if you look, Boeing over the last 35 years has done that numerous times. And I have confidence they'll do that again.
I wonder if we can talk a little bit more about agriculture, especially as it relates to trade. First, I just wanted to ask you, I know you've had, ahead of the last month's trip to China, I know you led a bipartisan delegation there last month. I know you've had many conversations with the administration official who's in charge of these negotiations. That's Ambassador Robert Lighthizer, current U.S. Trade Representative. What's he saying right now about the stance the Trump administration is taking in trade negotiations and trade relations with China?
Well, I think he's cautiously optimistic. You know, I've said for a long time that, you know, I'm not a fan of tariffs. Tariffs are taxes. They're taxes on consumers. And you look at the effect that tariffs and retaliation has had on our farmers in central and west central Illinois. It has hurt it. The farm economy is down about 13% over last year as a direct result of that. However, I give the Trump administration credit for bringing the Chinese to the table. Tariffs have worked in a strategic way here to cause their economy to slow down. Their stock market is hurting. This is the first time they've come to the table. So Lighthizer is a tough negotiator, but he's trying to structurally reform the way China does business. If you think about it, China has been ripping us off for 25 years in the technology space, forced technology transfers, stealing our intellectual property, cyber theft. And it's not just us, Nyla. It's the Europeans that are frustrated. It's the Japanese. It's the Koreans. It's every other industrialized country in the world that's frustrated with the Chinese. And so we have them at the negotiating table now, and we are hopeful that we can get a better deal. And what we're trying to get them to do is act like a first world country, abide by the same laws and rules that we do, treat our companies the same when they go to China as their companies are when they come to the United States. That has not been happening. And so we are at a critical juncture with these negotiations. And, you know, we just had the Chinese chief negotiator, Liu He, in D.C. over the weekend. I think there was good progress made there. But in the end, we want structural change from the Chinese.
And so what else would that structural reform look like when it comes to trade with us? You've mentioned a few things. I wonder if there are specifics that you're also looking for here.
Well, I think that, again, using the tariffs in a manner that says once an agreement gets signed, it's only as good as the two parties and their enforcement mechanisms. So what do I mean by that? I think this administration is looking at what I would call a new program to put in place with tariffs called a snapback provision, which would mean once the agreement's signed and say a month or 2 months into the agreement, the Chinese continue to violate intellectual property rules. They don't protect our cloud services over there, or they continue to steal our products, then what we can do is those tariffs can be snapped back into place. Now, it doesn't happen unilaterally. There'll be negotiations between Lighthizer and their chief negotiator, but we have to have a hammer over their head when they don't abide by the rules that they claim they're going to do. Because really, if you look at past agreements that have been entered into, the Chinese say all the right things, but the enforcement is never there. So I think this snapback enforcement tariff mechanism is new, and I think it could be the key to getting this done.
Your Democratic colleague Sherry Bustos recently introduced a Cuba Agricultural Exports Act. That's bipartisan legislation to expand trade opportunities for American farmers and manufacturers in Cuba. Is this something you would support?
Absolutely. I'm on the Cuba Working Group. I look at the opportunities that Cuba has. You know, they have a small market, but the more corn and soybeans or John Deere products that we can sell to Cuba is good for our economy. And I'm a big believer that, economic change to a place like Cuba will result in all boats rising. I compare all the time. You look at Vietnam. We have one of the most robust, muscular trade agreements with Vietnam that is directly benefiting the United States and our products. That should be the same philosophy we take with Cuba. I know there is political pressure from South Florida and New Jersey with Cuban dissidents that hate the Castro regime, and I understand that. But we need to move on like we did with Vietnam, and I'm a strong supporter of opening up ties with Cuba.
Representative LaHood, you also worked very closely with Sherry Bustos on the Peoria Ag Lab. At this point, I imagine you feel confident about future funding being secure for the Ag Lab?
Well, let me just say the Ag Lab is a wonderful asset, not only for Illinois, but for the entire country. We have 200 folks that work there. These are the top PhD researchers, engineers that work on agriculture. And I worked in a bipartisan way to make sure that that was kept off the closure list. I worked with the Trump administration, and I give the president credit for keeping it off there. Now we have to make sure that we market the Ag Lab better. We have not done a good job in doing that. But the work they do on food safety, the work they do on corn and soybeans byproduct and how those byproducts are used in the private sector, we need to highlight that. We need to market that. We need a cheerleader that can do that better and expand the Ag Lab. So it's a real asset for us in Illinois. I look forward to continuing to work in a bipartisan way to keep that open and promote agriculture. My district's the eighth largest ag district in the entire country in terms of corn and soybean production. So it was a win to keep it off the list. And again, I commend the Trump administration for doing that.
And when we're thinking particularly about ethanol production, which is very big also as well in your district, we know that flooding recently has hurt local ethanol markets. The floodwaters have made it harder to deliver corn and ethanol, especially via rail. I wonder what you're doing or what you say to ethanol producers to be worried about prospects in the long term, especially as we're seeing more and more flooding like this become, I don't want to say more commonplace, but certainly it's happening more often.
Well, I would say two things on that. One is we have to expand ethanol, the E15 provision. Right now, the EPA is writing new rules to have E15 year-round. That's going to be good for corn production and for ethanol. Secondly, it becomes more important infrastructure, the locks and dams on the Illinois and the Mississippi rivers, which much of the ethanol travels up and down those rivers, and a lot of other commodities. So infrastructure investment, I was proud that I was able to secure $75 million for the lock and dam at LaGrange, just south of Beardstown. It's a pivotal point on the Illinois River that gets, again, a lot of ethanol down to New Orleans and gets shipped all over the world. But those are two things. And lastly, I would just say disaster relief. That's been held up in the Senate, unfortunately, but that's about $13 billion in disaster relief. Some of that will go to flooding along the Mississippi and Illinois rivers, and I look forward to supporting that once it gets to the House.
Next Monday is tax day, and I just wanted to end by asking about a bill you've just introduced to help improve access to for taxpayers to get help at the IRS. Obviously, you think what's being done right now isn't sufficient?
Well, there's a lot of frustration with the IRS in not being really attentive, being business friendly. And again, that's Republicans and Democrats that have expressed that over a long period of time. We do have a new IRS commissioner who came from the private sector. And I was proud to sponsor this bill in a bipartisan way with a number of my Democrat colleagues that really makes the IRS more user friendly, particularly as it relates to complaints, whether it's tax preparers, whether it's individuals, whether it's citizens, and that those concerns, and those inquiries need to be responded in a timely way. And so that's what our bill does, and allocates some resources to do that, directs the IRS to do that, and puts in place a mechanism that, again, makes the IRS attentive, which in the past they have not done that.
That's Representative Darren LaHood, a Republican from Illinois' 18th Congressional District, which includes all or part of 19 counties across central and western Illinois, including Peoria, Springfield, and Bloomington-Normal. Representative, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Always good to be with you, Nyla. Thank you.
Yesterday afternoon, President Trump continued a shakeup of the Department of Homeland Security. The director of the Secret Service is also out, and CNN reports that the head of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services could leave as well. Senator Dick Durbin has released a short statement responding to Secretary Nielsen's resignation. He said, quote, Kirstjen Nielsen bears personal responsibility for the zero-tolerance program, which forcibly separated 2,800 infants and children from their parents under her watch. Her departure would be encouraging were we not warned that President Trump is looking for a successor who will engage in even harsher tactics. There appears to be no limit to the cruelty of this administration when it comes to its failed immigration policies. Again, that's U.S. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois. Stay tuned to this NPR station for more on this story throughout the day. Later this hour, we'll be talking fish fries, whether you're observing Lent by not eating meat on Fridays, or if you're just craving fried fish, there are plenty of good local places throughout the state. And we want to hear your favorite. Here's our number. Save it in your phone so you can text us. It's 217-394-5765. That's 217-394-5765. Please send us your first name, too, so we can read it on the air. But we want to hear your favorite place for a local fish fry. And by the way, we're on Spotify now. If you search for the 21st, that's one way to listen to past shows. You can check us out there. Coming up, if you fly, you need to tune in to how identification will be changing next year. The latest on Real ID is coming up on the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Don't go too far. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you've ever flown, you know the drill. Have your boarding pass and ID out and ready. But starting next year, your regular old Illinois driver's license will no longer do the trick. You'll need something called a Real ID to board a domestic flight. It looks almost identical to your current driver's license, except for a small gold star in the right-hand corner. And after more than a decade of back and forth, the Illinois Secretary of State's office officially began issuing Real IDs at some facilities in January. And as of last month, all Illinois residents are able to get the new driver's license and state IDs. For more on this, Henry Hopt is on the line with us. He's a spokesman for the Illinois Secretary of State's office. Dan Petrella is also with us. He's a state government reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Henry, Dan, good morning. Thanks for being here. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Good morning, Nyla. How are you?
Thanks for having us.
Good. Thank you. Henry, I wonder if you can just explain why a Real ID was created. How is it different from a regular driver's license?
Absolutely. I think it's best to give just a quick overview. The Real ID Act is a federal mandate by the United States Department of Homeland Security, and it sets federal standards for state-issued driver's licenses and ID cards for air travel and entering secure federal buildings. Illinois residents have a choice between a Real ID card or their standard driver's license or ID card. Essentially, a Real ID is a new type of Illinois driver's license or ID that meets the enhanced federal requirements and increased security measures. As of October 1 of 2020, if you are flying domestically or you wish to enter a nuclear power plant or a military base and you don't have a U.S. passport, you'd be required to have a Real ID. And again, that does not take effect until October 1 of 2020. And in Illinois, like many of the states that are issuing Real IDs, residents are not required to get the new card. Rather, they can choose to keep their current standard driver's license or ID, depending on their lifestyle. If they don't fly domestically, they may not need a real ID. And if they have a valid U.S. passport, that's an acceptable alternative.
Does the real ID cost more than the regular driver's license?
Not in Illinois, it does not. It's $30 for a real ID driver's license, same as the standard driver's license. I know some states are charging more, but Secretary White did not want to do that to customers. If I could make just a couple other quick points that we're really trying to highlight, and that is there's no rush to get a real ID because it doesn't take effect until October 1 of 2020. However, if you choose to get one, we are asking you to please visit our website at realid.ilsos.gov. That's realid.ilsos.gov. The federal government requires more documents to apply for a real ID, and we want to make sure that our customers are bringing in all the necessary documents that the Department of Homeland Security requires. And on our website, we've designed an interactive checklist to help residents go through and make sure they have the right documents. And at the end of that, they can print it. It's a single page, and it will list the documents that they chose to satisfy each of the four criteria, which are there's four: identity and proof of lawful status. That's one. Proof of full social security number. Two forms that prove residency, that could be a utility bill or a bank statement, and proof of signature, which can be their current driver's license or ID card. So we ask that they bring in those documents, and then they can apply for a real ID. And the last point we're making, we want to be upfront and very clear to our customers. The application process for a real ID takes longer at the facility than a standard driver's license or ID card application, simply because more documents are required by the federal government. So we're just asking people to please be patient and to not be surprised if their time at the facility is longer when they're applying for a real ID.
That's Henry Haupt with the Illinois Secretary of State's office. Dan Petrello is also with us with the Tribune. Dan, when we're thinking about the kind of changeover that's happened, I wonder if you can just let us know a little bit, first of all, about the fact that real IDs are not a new concept for Illinois. When we think about back in 2005, Congress passed the Real ID Act in response to a recommendation from the 9/11 Commission. Where is Illinois when it comes to other states in terms of implementing this?
Illinois is sort of among some of the later adopters, although there are still about 11 states, I believe, that are not in full compliance with the law yet. But there's been a lot of back and forth. You know, it's been over a decade in trying to implement this law. Back in 2007, actually, the General Assembly passed a non-binding resolution opposing the idea, calling it, you know, an unfunded mandate from the federal government, which might strike some people as ironic, because lots of people like to talk about the General Assembly passing on unfunded mandates to local governments and school districts. But it was wrangled over in the legislature for years, and I believe it was not until the late summer of 2017 that the General Assembly gave legal authority to go ahead with creating the Real ID here in Illinois. It's been an issue that's created a lot of confusion and consternation for people over the years. Back at the beginning of 2016, there was the word going around that people in Illinois weren't going to be able to board planes with their regular driver's licenses, and then there was a reprieve granted by the federal government then. So it's even after I wrote the story, I feel like the Secretary of State's office was pretty clear about what the requirements were. I got some emails from some readers who were confused, and so obviously there's still a lot of work to do about educating the public about how this is all going to work.
Right. And so, Dan, to that point, just a reminder for everybody. So this doesn't take effect until October of next year when we're thinking about domestic flights. What other key facts do you think people need to know in terms of thinking about this? People, we're giving people plenty of time here to figure out how to handle this.
And sure, like Henry said, I think one important thing to remember is that the Secretary of State's office has made it pretty clear that, you know, if you don't fly regularly or you don't enter secure federal government facilities or nuclear power plants, you might not need to get this new form of ID. One thing I did ask about, because I know I did it last time I renewed my driver's license, is the Real ID won't be able to be renewed by mail. You'll have to come in and do it in person. And Henry can correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I know that was one thing that occurred to me. And I think it's just really important that people, you know, weigh whether this is something they need or if they are fine just using their passport when they fly, or whether it's worth having this different form of identification.
Right. So I want to thank Dan Petrella. He is a state government reporter with the Chicago Tribune. We'll tweet out Dan's stories about this, by the way, if you want more information. Henry Haupt has also been with us, a spokesman for the Illinois Secretary of State's office. Henry, Dan, thanks for being with me. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to continue talking about airlines and air travel for a minute here and talk about one of Illinois' biggest companies, and that's Boeing. It's been nearly a month since Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 crashed just 6 minutes after takeoff. All 157 passengers and crews were killed. They were on board a Boeing 737 MAX 8. It's a name you're probably familiar with by now because last month's crash was actually the second one in 5 months. In Indonesia, another 189 people were killed in October. Both crashes involved what appear to be similar problems with the MAX 8. Since then, this particular model has been grounded both in the U.S. and around the world. And all the while, Chicago-based Boeing has been facing all kinds of questions, whether it's the future of the 737 MAX 8 or whether these two crashes could have been prevented. Claire Bushy has been reporting on this for Crane Chicago Business, and she's on the line now from there. Hi, Claire. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi. Thank you for having me back.
Claire, I wonder if we can just start with the 737 MAX 8 and what we've learned about this jet in the last few weeks. Why these crashes happened, how much clarity we have on that now?
Well, it is obviously still something that is being pieced together because the investigation of the Ethiopian Airlines crash is ongoing. However, investigators came out with their preliminary crash report, and they say that it is similar to the Lion Air crash in October in that an anti-stall system was triggered by information from a single sensor, and that triggered the plane to go into a downward dive. Investigators say that the Ethiopian Airlines pilots followed Boeing's instructions to try to deactivate the anti-stall software that triggered this. And there is currently some dispute about whether they did that correctly or not.
And so right now we're looking at all of the planes, all 737 MAX 8 have been grounded, but we've also seen news about production. And I wanted to ask you about that in terms of how much production has been affected by this issue.
Very much so. Boeing has been producing 52 737 MAXs a month at its plant in Renton, Washington, and they just announced on Friday that they're going to cut that to 42. They had been planning on ramping up this year to 57, and so this is going to be sending shockwaves in both directions to their customers who wanted their new planes and their suppliers who had been, you know, ramping up their workforce to feed Boeing the parts that it would need to assemble the planes.
Mm-hmm. And when we're thinking about customers, are we also seeing customers who are saying they didn't want the planes because of the two incidents?
So far, there's been one airline, Garuda, it's an Indonesian airline, that has said that it wants to cancel its order. However, so far, they are the only airline to do so.
And when we're thinking about the crashes and how many, I mentioned earlier, 346 people died. Yesterday, the family of an American who died in the Ethiopian Airlines crash actually filed a lawsuit against Boeing. This was actually in Chicago, Claire?
Yes, there's been at least three dozen lawsuits filed so far, and almost all of them are filed either in the Cook County Circuit Court or in the Northern District of Illinois. They're currently all being consolidated onto the federal docket of Judge Thomas Durkin.
And so I think this is probably a good reminder for folks, Claire, when people think about Boeing, they don't necessarily think of them as an Illinois company, but the company's headquarters are based in Chicago.
Yes. Chicago won the bake-off some 15 years ago for Boeing when it was looking to relocate its corporate headquarters. There's about 600 people who work in an office in downtown Chicago, but all their operations, the where they actually build stuff, it's either in Washington or South Carolina.
And how is Boeing responding to these lawsuits that now we understand why they're being filed here, because the headquarters is based here?
Indeed. They are trying to do what's a pretty typical move in these cases, which is to get them dismissed in U.S. courts and have the cases be tried in either Indonesia or in Ethiopia, because the U.S. justice system affords considerably more damages to plaintiffs than foreign countries in most cases.
So in other words, it's more expensive here than it would be in other countries to pay out those claims?
So much more expensive. And it doesn't just have to do with the paying of claims. It also has to do with the expense of legal counsel here in this country.
Mm-hmm. And so when we're looking at Boeing share prices, I know yesterday the company's shares dropped more than 4%. How is the company's financials being affected by all of this?
Well, I mean, we should keep that in perspective. I mean, Boeing brought in $100 billion with a B in revenue in 2018. They had $10 billion in profit. So even though this is absolutely a big bite for the company, it's, Boeing is not going to cease to be a going concern anytime soon. It's costing them a lot of money in cash flow because they were planning on delivering their planes to customers. They're now all sitting on the ground, kind of stacking up. And so they're having a cost of anywhere between $1 billion and $2 billion a month for as long as the planes stay grounded. But in the broader scheme of things.
Right, when we're talking about $100 billion in revenue.
Right.
Right. And I don't know if this is harder to, obviously this is harder to measure, but what about the company's reputation? I don't know what analysts and other folks are saying about how they're quantifying that change over the past few weeks. I'm assuming there is one.
It's definitely hard to quantify. A reputation for safety, which Boeing has in spades, is one of those things that you build up over decades, and it can go away really quickly. I think it's too soon to put a number on that.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about the regulatory side of this. We earlier in the program were talking to Republican Darren LaHood, who said he still has a lot of confidence in Boeing leadership, but then he did say, of course, he wants the FAA and all of the proper investigations to happen. They need to get to the bottom of this. The FAA did take some heat for initially not grounding the Boeing jet, the 737-8 MAX, after we saw Europe and everyone else, including the UK, saying that this plane, this model, was going to be grounded. What's the agency's role in all of this going forward?
Boeing and the FAA have sort of a weird relationship. It goes back a very long time, almost from, when commercial jets started to be a major force. Boeing's ability to innovate and create new products outpaced the FAA's ability to regulate it. It comes down to resources. The FAA cannot pay an engineer what Boeing can pay an engineer. They don't have the budget, and they don't have the number of people that they need. And so what you have now is a system that was formalized in 2005 where you actually have Boeing employees acting as FAA designees to certify the safety of the plane. So it is not an FAA inspector who's signing off. It is a Boeing employee acting on behalf of the FAA who is signing off.
Claire, we're almost out of time, but is there any sense that that would change, yes or no?
Well, Congress needs to give the FAA more money before that can change.
Okay, thanks for that. Claire Bushey is a reporter with Crane's Chicago Business. She covers manufacturing and Boeing. We will tweet out Claire's reporting on this as she's been following this ongoing story. Claire, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're driving around Illinois looking for something to eat, it's not too hard to find a fish sandwich special on Fridays this time of year. That's, of course, not a coincidence. For many Christians who observe Lent, eating fish on Fridays has historically been a common way to abstain from eating during the lead up to Easter Sunday. And even though this is the time of year lots of restaurants add fish to their menus, for many churches, feeding people fish is a good way to build community and raise money. If you're not looking for a fish sandwich, you might just find a good fish fry at a church near you. And we're going to talk about that now. One of those fish fries is in Urbana at St. Patrick's Catholic Church. Joseph Joachim has been working at their fish fries for years. He's with us now in our Urbana studios. Hi, Joseph. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Donna. Thank you.
Well, I'm also joined on the line by Mary Carter. She's the founder of Carter's Fish Market in Springfield. Hi, Mary. Good morning.
Hi.
And for all of you listening, you're always welcome to join the conversation. You can tell us a great fried fish place. We just heard from Consuelo in Cherry Valley, just outside Rockford. She texted that the best fish in town is at St. Rita Catholic Church. Not only fish, but Consuelo says there's great salad, soup, and beverages. You can text us too, 217-394-5765. You can save this number in your phone. It's 217-394-5765. And please send us your first name so we can read it on the air. We've got a couple more we'll get to in a minute. But Joseph, how often do you have the fish fries at St. Patrick's?
Only during Lent. We have like 6 weeks. And this week is the last one we are doing because next week is Holy Week.
Okay. And how long have you been volunteering?
About 20 years.
About 20 years?
Yeah, something like that.
And how many folks do you have coming to the Friday Fish Fries?
We average about 110 to 120, you know, people. And every week we have like new people coming in to try our fish and they like it and they say they'll come again.
Okay. This is the only time of year that St. Patrick's is doing like these meals and feeding people, right?
Well, we're feeding fish.
Feeding fish. So Right. You guys are used to creating meals for lots of people. This is the only time that it's a fish meal.
Yes.
Is there any particular logistics that make that different?
Yes, it's Lent. And it's also we use the opportunity to build a community and faith growing. And we are really combined with St. Mary in Catholic Church in Urbana, in Champaign. So, and we use together, actually our fish meal is a Mexican style fish meal. So it is, we have like baked fish and we marinated the night before with a special Mexican recipe. And we do fried fish and then we have cod fish soup and we do salsa from scratch and we have chips, and we have also tostadas, and we have quesadilla, and we have green beans. And
this is a pretty extensive menu. It's not just fish. It's not just a fish fry.
Right. And this week, actually, we'll have extra 50 egg rolls, Vietnamese, all vegetarian.
Oh, okay. So we're talking about fish fries. You can text us your favorite place in Illinois, 217-394-5765. Ken says Artisan's Restaurant in South Beloit opened 1 year ago this month. Bread and deep fries, a walleye to absolute perfection. So he says Artisan's is outstanding from a fussy Chicagoan born in Milwaukee. So if you are searching for a great fish fry, we want to hear from you too. Mary, what is Carter's Fish Market like during Lent? I imagine, is it busier for you guys?
Oh, yes, it's just crazy. we can hardly even handle all the business from Lent. So we even have to take the phone off the hook.
Oh, my. So what do you stock in particular this time of year?
We have walleye, catfish fillets, catfish steaks, and catfish strips, and buffalo, scored buffalo, and shrimp is the fish that we carry. And then we have a bunch of sides, too, like fried green tomatoes and okra and slaw and potatoes, fried potatoes.
So, Mary, you founded Carter's Fish Market in Springfield back in 1983. How has the store changed over the years?
Well, back then, it was just a little sell retail fish, you know, just not cooking fish. And after about a year, we decided we need to move more fish, and we started cooking it, and it just gets better every year.
And so do you, you also cook fish for folks during Lent?
Oh, yeah.
And is that a bigger part of your market now than sell? Is the cooked fish, which one is bigger, the cooked or the uncooked fish?
Oh, the cooked fish is much bigger.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. Now, yeah. Joseph, I understand that you actually don't eat meat on Fridays year round. Is that something you've always done?
Yes, I don't usually eat meat. I eat like my meal always like lentils and rice on Fridays most of the time. But sometimes I do eat meat. You know,
but that's not is that a religious practice? Or
no,
is it just,
no, it's just me.
It's just you.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, for people who are doing this as a religious practice, I also wanted to welcome one more voice into the conversation. That's Christina Traina. She's a professor and chair of the Department of Religious Studies at Northwestern University. Hi, Christina. Welcome back to the 21st.
Good morning.
Christina, I wonder if you can tell us where the tradition of abstaining from meat comes from for Christians observing Lent.
It goes way, way back to the very early church when people were preparing for baptism at the Easter Vigil and would fast and abstain in order to prepare themselves to be received into the church. So it's a matter of depriving yourself in order to express sorrow for sin and desire for conversion. And it's also a matter of focusing one's attention on prayer instead of on what you want to fix for dinner. What's interesting about that is that at the very beginning, people were limited in general to plant products. And then over time, it was possible to add in various flesh products. The first flesh product that was added was in the 9th century when fish was added to the Western menu. And the Eastern Orthodox still don't eat fish with bones in it during Lent at all. So Roman Catholics had it easy at that point.
And so, I'm sorry, fish with bones in it? So then what do they, if you're Orthodox, what counts?
If you're Orthodox during Lent, you're going to eat plant products, but no wine or oil during weekdays. There's no egg, no dairy. You can have fish without bones or sea creatures without bones, and that would be shellfish.
Mm.
Catholics can also eat any cold-blooded flesh, so if you feel like eating a snake or a frog, that would be fine.
Okay. And or when we're thinking about the fish fry, I was raised Presbyterian. I'm Presbyterian. I feel like that was not something, it's not something you see as common in Protestant denominations as you do in Roman Catholic ones, correct?
Right. Protestants, at the time of the Protestant Reformation, Protestants became very concerned that practices like fasting and abstinence were ways of earning your way into heaven. And those kinds of practices were kind of dangerous because they imply that you could buy God off. And so Protestant denominations, by and large, stopped practicing fasting and abstinence. And Roman Catholics held on to it, but they have lessened the degree of fasting and abstinence all through history. So, for instance, until the 1960s, Catholics all abstained from meat every Friday of the year, not just during Lent. And that caused price drops for fish in the U.S. when that happened, and I think worldwide. So the rules for fasting and abstinence have gotten much easier for Roman Catholics over time, so that now Friday during Lent and Ash Wednesday are the only days for abstinence from meat.
Mm. And so if you drive around Illinois, I think you'll find a lot of restaurants with fish sandwich specials on Friday. And when we think about how much meat Americans eat, do you feel like Christians in the U.S., though, have kept up this tradition of whether it's no meat on Fridays or some people, try to do even more restrictive things during Lent, Christina?
Yes, I think people are keeping it up, but there's now some movement within different denominations of Christianity, not just Catholic and Orthodox, to ask the question, does eating meat harm the environment too greatly for us to continue doing it at the current level? So for those Christians, the emphasis on abstinence has changed from self-denial and focus on prayer to the environment. And that's a phenomenon we might want to watch. Those people might even say, well, we shouldn't eat ocean fish either. We should eat, as Joseph has just said, we should eat lentils and rice more often.
And that's Christina Trina. She's a professor and chair of religious studies at Northwestern University. Christina, did you abstain from meat during Lent when you were growing up?
I have followed the fasting and abstinence rules, yes, while I've been growing up and as an adult, too. But I have to say that I have sometimes thought that it would be a greater sacrifice on to eat Hamburger Helper on Friday than to eat shrimp. So we have to think about the real purpose of the rule.
Right. In terms of cost and sustainability and all of those things you're talking about. Joseph.
Right, and self-sacrifice.
Right. And self-sacrifice. Joseph Joachim is also in studio with us. He's worked, as he's saying, as he's been telling us, at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Urbana for 20 years with their fish fries. Joseph, you talked in the beginning about how this is a great opportunity for community. And I just wanted to ask you about, when you think of the many years you volunteered at Fish Fries, what memories stand out to you?
Well, I mean, basically, like when people come to eat at our church, we go out and sit with them and discuss like how they like the food. And, you know, if they're new, we ask them where they're from. So we ask them if they're Catholic or Christian or not Christian or just walking off the road. So we try to preach at the same time the gospel to them. You know, we try to help them understand the Lord's message, and it's not just eating the fish. So we try to build a community as much as we can. I mean, like last week, I met some Chinese student there. This is his first time, and he was happy. He was like eating, and he's by himself, and he said he'll come again, we'll bring his friends. I said, that's great. I said, this is the Lord, you know, providing us with these people, helping them to come here through the Holy Spirit so they can learn more about the gospel and, I mean, just eating fish too.
Mm-hmm. We've been asking you to text your favorite places to go across the state. Renee says the Moose Club of Sterling has a Friday fish fry 52 weeks a year that is excellent, and it helps the communities. Best of both worlds. We have a minute left if you want to text one more to us. 217-394-5765. Joseph, the money that you all raise through the fish fry, what does that go towards?
Scholarships for our high school students through the Father Mattel Scholarship, and it is divided between St. Patrick and St. Mary's School.
And so, Church. Okay, and I have to say, I have to remark on the fact that we have a Mary and a Joseph in this conversation. And so, Mary and Joseph, before we go, are there any tips for home cooks about what people should thinking about if they're cooking fish at home? Mary?
Oh, I always make sure you have clean grease and the right temperature, like 350 degrees, and I think that's two of the most important things.
Yeah, clean grease, hot oil. Joseph, what have you learned over the years?
Yeah, we use tilapia. It's easier to cook.
And you know, how important is the seasoning of this?
Well, the seasoning is very important. You know, so we do our own seasoning, and I use 350, and I keep timing it like about 20 to 25 minutes in the oven if it's baked. The other one's only 7 minutes.
Okay. That's Joseph Joachim, parishioner at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Urbana. I want to thank Mary Carter, the founder and owner of Carter's Fish Market in Springfield, and Christina Trina, professor and chair of religious studies at Northwestern University. All of you, thank you for taking time during Lent to join me to talk about this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. Later this week, we're going to be talking television. There's lots of big shows that are wrapping up this year, whether it's Game of Thrones, Big Bang Theory, Orange is the New Black, Veep. Which show are you most sad to say goodbye to? You can send us an email. That's talk@21stshow.org. You can text us. Again, that number is 217-394-5765. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. Our website, Agugra, is a great resource. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, remember our social media handles. All you have to remember is 21stShow.org. We've got all of our past shows there. They're also available on iTunes, Android, Spotify, most places you get your podcasts. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.